At first light, if one can even call it light, the day begins with screaming and ash. There is no sunrise here, only a gradual unveiling of the same gloom that never really left. This is life under chaos rule, a day-to-day existence so bleak and distorted that only by speaking it aloud can I remind myself it's real. I wake on a torn mattress in a charred tenement block, coughing out the tang of soot that coats my lungs. It's cold, or perhaps it's hot. I honestly can't tell anymore, as the air shifts between clammy and feverish in the warp-tainted climate. Around me, shapes stir in the half-dark. Other civilians, or what remains of us, rising reluctantly to face another cycle of the same nightmare routine. There is no rooster's call, no morning bell, only the crude blare of a vox horn somewhere in the ruins, crackling with harsh commands in a language part Gothic, part demonic litany. That is our reveille. We begin each day already exhausted, haunted by the screams that never truly fade from the previous night. If any of us managed to dream, those dreams were likely just as cruel. Twisted reflections of reality, courtesy of the warp. In truth, there is little distinction between nightmare and waking here. There is no leisure to our mornings, no moment to rub the sleep from our eyes or whisper a greeting to a loved one. Those who linger too long risk a lashing or worse. So we rise at once, a shuffling procession of gaunt figures, each of us clutching whatever rag or scrap passes for a coat. My breath comes out in a mist, the factories haven't warmed the air yet with their toxic output, and my joints ache from yesterday's labors. There's no breakfast whistle, no coffee, nothing but the acidic taste of fear to start the day. Many of us have stomachs gnawing hollow, but we know better than to go searching for food outside of sanctioned times. Doing so could mark you as a thief, and the punishment for that is public and final. We assemble in the courtyard, or what's left of it, a collapsed plaza of broken stone and effigies. There, under the cracked gaze of toppled imperial statues, now defaced and marked with the eight-pointed star, we line up in rows. Roll call is a droning affair. An overseer, one of the human collaborators draped in spiked leather and tattered finery, stalks past us with a data slate of quotas and numbers. He doesn't bother to learn our names. To him, we're just entries on a ledger of flesh. I keep my eyes downcast as he passes, as do we all. Eye contact can be misread as defiance. The morning air is filled with the stench of unwashed bodies and the coppery tang of dried blood that never really comes off the paving stones. Sometimes a booming vox speaker will lead a dawn prayer. A guttural recitation of blasphemous catechisms that we are expected to echo. The words burn in my throat. Praises to the dark gods, denunciations of the false emperor. We learned quickly never to even think of him as anything but false or accursed. Some mumble the responses dutifully, others with a sarcastic hiss under their breath if they're feeling brave, and some just move their lips soundlessly. It's safer to pretend zeal than to risk being spotted as unenthusiastic. The priests or overseers watching us can sense lack of fervor the way a hound smells fear, and woe betide anyone who doesn't seem sincere enough. I've seen poor fools dragged out of line and beaten because their voice cracked during the unholy pledges. So we chant with as much fake passion as we can muster, hoping to blend in with the chorus of the damned. Once, in the time of imperial rule, we had our own mourning rites. Pledges to the god emperor, banal work songs, that sort of thing. I used to find them tedious. Now I would give anything to hear a simple, honest hymn to the emperor instead of these vile utterances. It's grimly funny how the mind recalibrates what is normal. Once the obligatory mourning rites and headcounts are done, we march. There's no morning commute in the old sense. Instead, work gangs are prodded out to their designated toil under armed watch. I join a line of workers chained together at the neck, a living coffle shuffling through the gray half-light. The chain rattles with each step, a sound that has become the music of our lives. Our destination might be the ruins of a manufactorum, where we'll spend the day digging out scrap metal and hauling it to the forges, or perhaps the grand construction site that used to be our civic center. On some days, they send me to the slag pits or the refineries, on others to help tear down what remains of the old governor's palace, feeding the rubble into hungry furnaces. The work details are rotated only when a task is done, or when enough of us have died that they need to reshuffle bodies. In the eyes of our masters, we are interchangeable parts of a vast, miserable machine. The labor itself is lethal drudgery. Picture a landscape of collapsed hab blocks and gutted temples, all of it being cannibalized for materials. Smoke-belching, demon-forged machines growl and churn, pushing aside debris or drilling into the earth, their engines screaming like tortured souls. We, the slaves, scurry in their wake, collecting stones and twisted metal beams by hand, because nothing, absolutely nothing, will be left to waste. Every brick from our former lives is repurposed for the conqueror's grand designs. To be fair, life here was harsh even before chaos came. This was never a paradise under the Imperium. I grew up amid the smog of factory stacks and the boot of Imperial authority. We were used to long shifts and cruel punishments even then. But there were rules, structure, a distant promise that our toil served some greater human cause, even if that promise was hollow. Under chaos, there is no pretense of a greater good. Misery is dispensed arbitrarily, for its own sake or for dark amusement. In a morbid way, it's almost honest. They don't sugarcoat the whip with slogans of duty. They just lash us because they can. I often find myself stumbling over skulls and charred servo skulls, half buried in the rubble, remnants of the life that was. We toss even those into the recycler if ordered. There's a bitter irony in it. We're dismantling the last traces of our own civilization to build monuments to our enslavers. Corpses are a common obstacle. There are always corpses. Many are from the invasion, some are more recent, unfortunates who collapsed from exhaustion or were randomly executed. We drag the bodies into piles on the side. Sometimes a separate crew comes by to collect them. Other times they just lie there until they rot or until the next round of demolitions buries them again. On particularly vile days, we've been ordered to strip the dead of clothing and valuables, some to be recycled for cloth or leather, some presumably as trophies. I've done it with numb hands, gagging at the sight of a neighbor's face frozen in terror as I pull the boots off his stiffening feet. Respect for the dead doesn't exist here. The bodies are fuel for the war machine in one way or another. There are whispers that some of those cadavers end up in the so-called meat factories, ground and processed to feed us in disguise. I wish I could dismiss that as a lie. But the taste of our ration broth is sometimes suspicious. Not far away, massive smelteries belch fumes. I've watched them tip entire heaps of debris, stone, metal, bone, all of it, into glowing vats. The conquering priests have a vision for this place. They melt our world down and recast it into something new and profane, brick by blackened brick. We are the ones who feed the furnaces, stoking them with the detritus of everything we once held dear. Hours grind by. Our backs bend and our hands bleed as we haul load after load of wreckage. Thick dust mixes with the acrid chemical smoke in the air, forming a coating on our tongues and in our lungs. Coughs are common, a dry, rasping chorus from chests long blackened by soot. Some workers develop racking, bloody coughs that never stop. They usually don't last long after that. Every few minutes I hear the crack of a whip or the buzz of a shock prod as the overseers keep us in line. Those overseers come in several varieties, none of them pleasant. A few are just traitor guardsmen with hard eyes and lazy smirks, content to bully us with their rifles. Others are far worse. There's a cadre of them who wear skin-tight, oily black suits and featureless masks with grill-like vox mouths, a glimpse of those, and you pray you won't draw their attention. Their voices rasp out in some infernal language, which a built-in translator spits into low Gothic commands. Work faster, no slacking, heave, you filth, and so on. These ones have syringes or needle-tipped claws in place of fingers, and they use them freely. I've seen them jab a man in the spine for pausing a heartbeat too long. The poor fellow spasmed and shrieked as whatever was injected burned through him. He got up and worked after that. He had no choice. The alternative was being dragged off for discipline, and anyone taken for discipline never returns in one piece, if at all. We are all acutely aware that one person's failure can doom the rest. I remember a time when a man in the chain ahead of me, an older fellow whose name I never knew, simply crumpled from exhaustion. He was carrying a chunk of rockcrete bigger than he could manage, and his legs gave out. The chain between us jerked taut. Instinctively, I stopped, which made the man behind me stumble. In that brief moment of chaos, the overseers descended. They were on us like crows on carrion. One of the black-suited devils drove his needle hand right into the fallen man's neck without a word. Another lashed me across the shoulders for slowing down. Searing agony lanced through me, but I dared not cry out. They hate when we scream without permission. The man on the ground twitched violently, as whatever toxin they pumped into him did its work. By the time they yanked the needle out, he had gone still, dead or paralyzed. I'm not sure, but he wasn't moving. They didn't even bother unchaining him. Two guards just hacked through the iron link connecting his collar to the line and dragged his limp body away. We all stared straight ahead, pretending nothing happened, even as we stepped over the blood he left behind. Nothing halts the work. If you collapse, you become just another obstacle to be cleared. Mercifully, there is usually a short break at what I assume is midday. Time is hard to measure here. There's no sun to gauge, just the ceaseless, smoky twilight. But eventually a discordant horn will sound, two sharp blasts that signal us to stop. We sag to the ground wherever we stand, too weary to care about the jagged rubble under our feet as we sit. My muscles tremble with relief despite the knowledge that the respite is brief. An overseer trundles down the line with a container slung on his back, distributing our so-called sustenance. It's always the same, a greasy, lukewarm protein gruel dispensed in tin cups or sometimes directly into our cupped hands. Today it's a muddy brown sludge that tastes of iron and bile. I choke it down because I must. Everyone does. It's swallow or starve, and none of us have the strength to refuse. A few newcomers retch the first time they taste it, but they learn. Either you get it down and keep it down, or you won't last long. I try not to dwell on what might be in it. The nutrition paste the Imperium used to give us was bad, but at least I knew it was made from corpse starch and recycled plant matter. Now, well, best not to speculate. It keeps us alive, that's all that matters in the moment. Around us, the ever-present noise of the war machines and distant chanting never fully stops. Oftentimes, a floating vox drone, Discord, they call it, hovers nearby even during our break, emitting a low cacophony of whispers and screams just quiet enough to form an unnerving background. It's never quiet here. Even in moments of rest, there is something invading your mind, a noise, a smell, a prickle on your skin that reminds you the dark gods are always watching. Sometimes our toiling is interrupted by the passage of our overlords. This afternoon, for instance, a column of red-armored Chaos Space Marines marches down the avenue beside the worksite. At the shrill blast of a whistle, we all scramble to clear a path, pressing ourselves against rubble piles or lying flat on our faces as required. We dare not lift our eyes. Even the overseers bow their heads when the Astartes go by. I can feel the heavy thud of their ceramite boots through the ground and the electric tang of their presence, an aura of pure menace that raises the hairs on my neck. They barely acknowledge us. To them, we are less than insects. Still, I sense a kind of excitement rippling through them today. Even through layers of terror, you learn to read these things. Perhaps a new offensive is about to begin elsewhere, or some unholy ritual is imminent. Whatever it is, after they pass, the work overseers drive us even harder, as if inspired by the warrior's presence. Fear trickles down the hierarchy, and we at the bottom always catch the worst of it. As the cycle of labor drags toward what would be evening, exhaustion becomes a living thing gnawing at us. There is no natural dusk, only a deepening of the smog overhead and the flicker of firelight from the forge temples on the horizon. Eventually, a horn signals the end of our work shift, though it's not mercy, just necessity. Even slaves work at diminished capacity when utterly spent, and our overseers know it. We are herded back toward our habitation zones in ragged groups, under guard. Some of us are so tired we can barely walk straight. The chains are removed from our collars only once we're secured behind walls and fences for the night. Not out of kindness, of course, but because we've nowhere to run and no strength to run with. Nights in the hab zones are a different kind of torment. We're crammed dozens to a room in whatever structures still stand, mostly half-ruined hab blocks reinforced with scrap metal. Some sleep on cots or mats if they're lucky. Most of us just huddle on cold stone or packed earth floors. The only light comes from sputtering torches or braziers set in the hallways, casting red shadows that dance on the walls like imps. The smell inside is rank, a sour mixture of sweat, blood, and despair. We collapse into our corners, muscles on fire, blisters open and raw. A few try to tend to their wounds with dirty rags or share whispered advice on how to avoid infection, not that you really can. Clean water is a luxury. We get a small allocation in grimy tin cans, barely enough to slake thirst, let alone wash away grime. I usually swallow my share with a gratitude that borders on absurd. Imagine being thankful for a mouthful of water that tastes faintly of rust and rot. But that's what we've become. Outside, a curfew is in effect. None of us would dare step beyond the threshold of our shelter now. After the work shifts, the streets belong solely to the occupiers and their chosen hunters. I've heard the guttural growls of mutant warhounds echoing in the distance and the clank of heavy boots as patrols move through the ruins on the lookout for any soul foolish enough to wander. We are penned in for the night, like cattle in a corral. Sometimes I see the pale beam of a searchlight sweep past the gaps in our boarded-up windows, or hear the whir of a surveillance servitor drone buzzing by, making sure we are where we're supposed to be. Anyone caught outside without authorization after dark is as good as dead. Likely worse than dead, actually, because they usually make an example of such victims come morning. Inside these overcrowded rooms, we speak rarely and softly. The walls have ears. Some say literally, given the strange sigils carved into every other corner by the sorcerers. No one knows what surveillance trickery or warp-spawned listening devices might be at work, so we keep our voices to whispers if we must talk at all. In the early days, some people would quietly reminisce or mutter prayers for deliverance. Now, most just sit in numb silence or weep where they think no one will notice. A few still offer what comfort they can. A shared blanket, a half-remembered lullaby hummed under the breath, a mumbled encouragement that tomorrow might not be as bad, though we all know it will be. These small gestures are all that remain of normal human kindness, flickers of warmth in an otherwise unrelentingly cold existence. We cling to them, even as we know that compassion here is as dangerous as defiance. Display too much concern for another, and you might be accused of forming a fellowship or a plot. More than once, an act of kindness has been repaid with the crack of a bolter if the guards suspected solidarity among us. So even our compassion is stealthy, subdued, done in secret and without fanfare. When sleep finally comes, it is rarely a peaceful or deep slumber. Nearly everyone here is plagued by nightmares, vivid and cruel. You can hear people whimpering or grinding their teeth in their sleep all around. I am no different. My dreams replay the horrors of the day or conjure new ones from the warp-tainted ether. On occasion, I have jolted awake to the sound of someone screaming in the dark, only for it to choke off abruptly. Whether it was just a night terror or something worse is hard to tell. Sometimes we wake to find a bunk empty and its occupant gone without a trace. Perhaps they were taken in the night by the overseers for some infraction. Or perhaps something else slithered in and snatched them. In this place, even our imaginations don't feel far-fetched. Reality itself has become a horror tale. And so it goes day after day, a ceaseless cycle of dread and drudgery. In a sense, the routine itself becomes our world, hideously predictable in its agonies, yet somehow we come to rely on that predictability. You stop asking when it will end. You stop imagining that it could be otherwise. This is simply life now, measured in shifts and screams and the pauses in between. If our day-to-day existence is a slow bleed, there are moments that spike into outright nightmare. Rituals and atrocities that stand out even against the background of constant horror. Every so often, the masters declare a grand ceremony or a festival in honor of their dark gods. These are not celebrations by any human measure, though we are all required to attend and to pretend our utmost devotion. I recall one such night with perfect clarity, try as I might to forget. It was the anniversary of the planet's fall, and the Word-Bearers hosted a massive midnight congregation in the former central square. Thousands of us were herded at gunpoint into the ruins of what used to be our commerce hub, now refashioned into an open-air temple. The broken statues of imperial heroes had been piled in a corner like trash, replaced by towering spines of black iron, adorned with skulls and flickering hellfire braziers. We were forced to our knees in concentric rings around a raised dais. On that platform, their high priest, a dark apostle in Baroque, blood-red power armor etched with blasphemous scripture, addressed us. His voice boomed through amplifiers, delivering a sermon in a language none of us understood, certainly not High Gothic, probably the foul tongue of the warp. Yet somehow we understood the intent. Raw hatred and ecstasy rolled into one. The very sound made our teeth rattle. Around the apostle stood a cadre of chanting cultists, swaying and ululating, and behind them hulking giants in Terminator armor, pounded immense drums that throbbed like a heartbeat. Then came the sacrifices. They always have sacrifices. On this night, they dragged a line of prisoners up to the dais, our fellow citizens who had been deemed traitors to chaos, or perhaps just unlucky enough to be chosen. I recognized one, a teacher from my hab block, a gentlewoman who used to run the community creche. Now she was sobbing, bound in chains, painted with sigils in her own blood. One by one, the dark apostle offered them up. The details are hard to stomach, even now. He slit their throats over a great brass brazier, intoning praise to the blood god as their lifeblood hissed into the flames. Another he burned alive to please the prince of excess, her screams somehow harmonizing with the discordant choir. A third victim, a stout old man who stubbornly spat defiance until the end, was drowned in a vat of filth to honor the plague lord. Finally, a fourth offering, a young acolyte from the Administratum, if memory serves, was subjected to a fate perhaps worse than death. The apostle and his sorcerers chanted over him until unnatural flames engulfed his body. He didn't burn, instead he began to change, shrieking as extra limbs sprouted and his face melted into an ever-shifting blur. A sacrifice to the changer of ways, no doubt. By the end, what was left of him was dragged away, a mewling, mindless spawn. Each death was a prayer to a different ruinous power. We were ordered to cheer and give thanks for these offerings. Can you imagine? Our voices were thin and quavering, a few hysterical. But we cheered because the alternative was to be selected as an extra offering ourselves. What followed the bloodletting was worse in a way than the slaughter itself. The very air rippled with power. I remember a foul wind whipping through the plaza, carrying a chorus of otherworldly howls. Reality buckled. There's no other word for it. The space above the dais tore open in a bruise-colored gash, and shapes moved in the periphery of my vision. Impossible, contorted shapes that defied sense. Many around me pressed their faces to the ground in terror. I did the same, peeking only enough to catch glimpses, slavering demonic forms slithering out from that tear in the world, loping and winged silhouettes circling the apostle like delighted pets. The dark apostle raised his arms in triumph as a huge bestial entity took form in the air, its eyes like embers and its laughter sending vibrations through my skull. We were ordered to rejoice at this blessing. A few hundred of us cried out praises hysterically. Some simply screamed in panic. I think I just knelt there, quivering, mouthing whatever words might sound passable. In that moment, I was certain we would all be slaughtered next, devoured by the nightmares we'd conjured. But just as suddenly, the tear in the sky sealed. The demons vanished, or perhaps became invisible to us. The ritual was over. They had achieved whatever hellish purpose they intended. They left us alive, shaken, sobbing, minds forever scarred, but alive. I sometimes wonder if that was intentional, to let us live with the memory. Events like that are thankfully not everyday occurrences, but they loom large in our psyche. They are the punctuation marks of terror in an otherwise unending run-on sentence of misery. In the aftermath, we returned to our duties even more broken than before. If that sounds unbelievable, that common folk could witness literal demons materialize and then go back to digging ditches the next morning, well, that is the cost of survival. We compartmentalize. We bury the fear and horror deep because we must. The alternative is to fall to pieces, and there is no room for that here. Faith, or what passes for it, has shifted dramatically among the people. In the early days of the occupation, I remember many still whispered the Imperial Creed at night, clutching emblems of the Emperor hidden under their clothes. We begged for deliverance. We believed, hoped, that the Imperium would return in force, that the Emperor would hear our prayers. But deliverance never came. As the months turned to years, that hope withered like a plant in toxic soil. One by one, even the devout fell silent. Some concluded that the Emperor had forsaken us, or perhaps that he was no god at all, certainly no match for the very tangible gods we see worshipped around us now. The chaos propaganda doesn't relent either. Day and night we are bombarded with their heretical sermons, telling us that the ruinous powers alone hold truth and strength. I hate to admit it, but for some, the indoctrination works. I've seen broken men and women begin to nod along to the dark apostles' words, even muttering prayers to chaos under their breath when they think no one is watching. Maybe they truly convert, or maybe they just figure it's easier to survive if you worship the winning side. Sincerity and desperation can look very similar here. There are those among us now who have genuinely embraced the new order. whether out of true conviction or simply because it gives them a chance to climb out of the pit of victimhood, they don don the symbols of chaos with pride. These collaborators, once our neighbors, can be the cruelest of all. To prove their loyalty, they outdo even the occupiers in harshness. I know of a former city administrator who reinvented himself as a priest of the Dark Shins. He leads public denouncements of anyone suspected of imperial sentiment and personally oversees floggings. Another man, a factory foreman, eagerly reports any whisper of dissent among his work crew in exchange for marginally better food and a position of petty authority. We despise these turncoats, but we fear them even more. They walk among us, and we cannot tell who might be secretly in their number, ready to inform on a misplaced sigh or a wistful remark about the old days. The warp's touch has also left physical marks on many of us. Under the Emperor's rule, even a minor mutation was cause for execution or exile. Under chaos, mutation is openly rampant and sometimes encouraged. After long exposure to the warp-tainted atmosphere, and whatever foul energies saturate this place, it's no surprise that some of us have begun to change in body. I've seen co-workers develop strange patches of scales on their skin, or an extra joint in their fingers, or eyes that reflect in the dark like a beast's. The overseers rarely punish these. In fact, a few of them call such mutations blessings. One young lad who grew a small tentacle in place of his tongue was taken aside by a cult recruiter rather than sent back to the chain gang. I suppose the dark gods had a different use for him. Those with visible mutations often carry themselves with a conflicted air, pride that they were touched by chaos, mixed with fear that they might mutate further into something unrecognizable. Truth be told, that fear is justified. Now and then, someone undergoes a more dramatic change, a sudden, violent mutation that twists them into a mindless monstrosity, a chaos spawn. When that happens, the occupiers treat it as both entertainment and utility, sometimes unleashing the newly formed abomination like a rabid dog on whatever target suits them, or just putting it down if it's of no use. Either way, it's the one fate possibly more horrifying than simply dying, and every one of us knows it could strike anyone without warning. Sickness, too, has become part of daily life, but even disease is twisted to serve chaos here. In the cramped filth of our living quarters, contagions spread easily, fevers, flux, strange wasting illnesses that we have no names for. Under the Imperium, the Medicae, or Sanitation Corps, might have attempted to contain an outbreak, albeit coldly. Under chaos, the opposite often happens. The occupiers celebrate plagues. I recall a time a pestilence swept through our district, a horrific, bloating sickness that turned skin parchment yellow and caused bleeding from the eyes. Instead of isolating the sick or trying to cure it, the new authorities declared it a blessing of Grandfather Nurgle. They actually encouraged us to revere the disease, to let it run its course. They held a grotesque parade through the shanties, led by a chanting cult of pestilent fanatics who smeared themselves in filth and blessed the air with more corruption. The smell of decay was overwhelming. Bodies piled up in days. Some people did start praying to Nurgle in their desperation, reasoning that maybe if they showed devotion, they'd be spared. Did it work? Who can say? Perhaps those ones were the few who survived the plague with pox-marked faces and a lifetime of coughs as souvenirs. The occupiers certainly acted as if it were divine selection rather than luck. They even inducted the survivors into a dedicated Nurgle cult cell, giving them roles distributing fungus-ridden bread rations and tending to the next cycle of sickness. In this way, even our suffering is weaponized to strengthen their hold. It's not only disease or exhaustion that thins our numbers. Periodically, the overseers will conduct what amounts to a culling. They might show up during the night, or at shift change with lists of names or just a quota of warm bodies to collect. No explanation given. Those taken are simply herded onto transport trucks or landers and whisked away. Perhaps they're sent to the front lines as cannon fodder for some chaos war, or handed over to the Dark Mechanicum for experimentation, or offered en masse in a blood ritual on another world. We never find out. The empty bunks and the silence are all that remain of them. When these roundups happen, terror hangs over the barracks for days. You hope to the God Emperor, or whatever power you still secretly believe in, that your name isn't called next. It's a grim lottery. The winners are the unlucky ones. And the rest of us continue on, simultaneously guilty that we're relieved it wasn't us, and dreading that our turn will come in the next purge. Interestingly, the Chaos Masters are not a monolith of unity. They feud and scheme even among themselves. We've learned to recognize the signs, a change in the patrol colors, a new symbol painted over the old on the fortress walls, gunshots echoing from the occupiers' barracks at odd hours. It means one warband has supplanted another, or a champion has usurped his superior. When that happens, our lives can shift from one flavor of hell to another overnight. Once, the Chaos Lord, who initially led the occupation, left with his elite warriors to fight elsewhere, and a group of word-bearers, Dark Apostles, divided control of the planet among themselves. Their rivalry was palpable. They each vied to outdo the others in showing piety to the Dark Gods. For us, that meant an uptick in sacrificial demands and conflicting orders that got many slaves killed. Two apostles argued over whether more monuments should be built or more slaves sent off-world to aid a crusade. In the end, they split the difference by driving us twice as hard to do both. Another time, a minor civil war broke out between a corn-worshipping contingent and a sly Nesh cult within the garrison. They actually fought each other in the streets for a short while. We, the civilians, hid wherever we could while God-crazed warriors slaughtered each other over doctrinal minutiae, or personal vendettas. When the smoke cleared, the victors punished us for the mess as if it were our fault. That's the way of it. We pay the price for their internal conflicts every time. Even the planet itself is changing under Chaos rule. I sometimes wonder if the world is gradually becoming a demon world, piece by piece. The sky is often a strange color, not just the bruise of pollution, but swirls of sickly green or vivid purple lightning dancing in the clouds with no natural explanation. We've had rain that stank of sulfur and left rashes wherever it touched skin, and on one occasion a rain of actual blood that lasted an hour. The ground in some areas has become unstable. There are places where reality feels thin, where you walk past an alley and the shadows seem to reach for you, or you hear voices speaking in no language you know. Some buildings, what remains of them, have taken on a warped, melted appearance as if reshaped by an unholy hand. New growths, yes, growths, sprout from cracks in the pavement, pulsating fungal masses or thorny vines that whisper when you get close. We avoid those. When the planet itself starts sprouting teeth and eyes, you know things have gone truly mad. Unsurprisingly, many among us have lost their minds entirely. There are those who simply sit and rock in the corners of our quarters, unresponsive, their spirits evidently broken beyond repair. Others have fits of hysterical laughter or screaming and have to be restrained lest they draw the ire of the guards. A few even wander off into the wasteland beyond the city, choosing the unknown terrors of the wilds over the certain torment here. They never come back, and we assume they perished or became something unhuman out there. Part of me envies the truly mad. At least madness might offer an escape from fully grasping this nightmare. To understand everything, to remain sane and aware in this place, is its own torture. Hope, as a concept, has become a double-edged sword that most of us avoid grasping. In the beginning, we hoped fervently for liberation, for the Emperor's armies to arrive in glory and cast down our tormentors. But as I said, that hope died slowly and painfully. Now I'm not even sure salvation by the Imperium would mean what we imagined. We know what Imperial liberation often looks like. If this world were to be reclaimed, it's likely the Inquisition or the Astra Militarum would deem all of us irredeemably tainted anyway. At best, we'd be shuttled off to penal camps or work crews on some distant front. At worst, a cleansing virus bomb or firing squad would be our fate for having endured under chaos. A cruel irony, the very rescue we once prayed for might just finish what chaos began. So no, we don't really hope for deliverance anymore. We don't hope for anything. We exist, and that is all. I'm not sure why I'm even telling all of this. Maybe as a final act of defiance, to prove that someone remembered, that someone saw and understood what happened here. Perhaps these words are meant for a future soul, someone far away in time or space, who might stumble upon this account and struggle to believe that any of it could have really occurred. I wouldn't blame you for doubting. There are days even I, living through it, have to convince myself it's not just some fever dream. But it is real. This has been our life, our history, written in blood and fear under the boot heels of chaos. We know our names will not be recorded in any honor roll. No one will build a monument for us, save for the obscene spires we were forced to raise to glorify our captors. In all likelihood, when this is over, if it ever ends, our story will be swept aside or lost in the larger chronicles of galactic war. But I hope if these words do survive, that at least someone will remember that we were human, that we tried in our own feeble ways to hold on to our humanity in a place designed to strip it away. In the end, what more is there to say? We endure until we cannot. Each dawn, or whatever pale imitation of dawn passes for morning, we rise to the same nightmare, and each night we collapse thankful for the temporary oblivion of sleep, however haunted. There is no grand conclusion, no heroic triumph on the horizon for us. There is only the grind of another day, and then another, until one day we falter and join the countless dead in the shadows. If you are reading this, you stand in the light of a world that has perhaps never known this kind of darkness. Count yourself fortunate, and remember us. Remember that we were here, that we suffered, and that in the face of absolute despair, we lived as long as we could, even without hope. This, then, is the legacy of our days under chaos, an existence of unending night, survived only by the stubborn momentum of life itself, ending not with a bang or a whimper, but with a long, low sigh of resignation.